Good afternoon, and thanks to all of you for coming out today. We're here to learn about a new book written by Professor Akhil Amar entitled America's Constitution, a Biography. My name is Jim Ryan, and I will serve as moderator, which means primarily that I get to introduce this star-studded cast. I'll do so in the order in which they'll speak. John Harrison is the David Lurton Massey, Jr., Professor of Law, as well as the Horace W. Goldsmith Research Professor. I'm sure many of you know him because you've taken all of your classes from him. John is a graduate of this university and also a graduate of the Yale Law School. After law school, he worked in private practice and then clerked for Judge Robert Bork on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He then went on to a distinguished career in the Justice Department, where he worked from 1983 to 1993, serving in numerous capacities, including Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel. Since joining the faculty in 1993, John has taught an astonishing array of courses, including, and I think this is an incomplete list, constitutional history, civil procedure, foreign relations law, law and political participation, legislation, property, remedies, federal courts, I'm just getting warmed up, international law, federal income tax, and most recently, torts. I came to appreciate the institutional value of John's dexterity in teaching when I became responsible last year for putting together the curriculum. I now wait until near the end of the process so I know where the holes are, and then I ask John to fill them, knowing that he's probably either taught the course or willing to teach it. While he has not yet written in every subject, his scholarship is also wide-ranging, though much of it is historically based and focused on issues of constitutional interpretation and history, which makes him an excellent person to offer comments on Professor Amar's book. Equally well-qualified to this task is Risa Golubov, who joined the faculty in 2002. Professor Golubov earned her undergraduate degree from Harvard in 1994 and then spent the following year as a Fulbright scholar in South Africa, where she taught at the University of Cape Town. She earned her JD from the Yale Law School and both an MA and a PhD in history from Princeton. As if this were not quite enough, she also clerked for Judge Guido Calabresi, former dean of the Yale Law School and now a judge on the Second Circuit, and then for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. She teaches courses in constitutional law, civil rights history, civil rights litigation, equality in the law, and most recently, a course on poverty in the Constitution. Risa is a legal historian, and her scholarship focuses on civil rights, labor, and constitutional law in the 20th century. In 2004, she won the Law and Society Association Dissertation Prize for her work on civil rights in the 1940s. She is currently turning that dissertation into a book, which is to be published by the Harvard University Press and is tentatively entitled The Lost Origins of Modern Civil Rights. Last but not least is Professor Akhil Amar, the self-made professor of law at the Yale Law School. Akhil does not get out of New Haven very often. He's a graduate of Yale College and of the Yale Law School. After graduating from the law school, Akhil demonstrated his ability to pick a winner when he accepted a clerkship with then-judge, now Justice, Stephen Breyer, who at the time served on the Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. Akhil joined the Yale Law School faculty upon completing this clerkship, and he has since established himself as one of the leading constitutional scholars in the country. He's the author of numerous law review articles which collectively address nearly every provision of the Constitution, as amended. And he is the author or co-author of 5 books, including this most recent work, and also including an award-winning and path-breaking book on the Bill of Rights. He's a recipient of numerous professional awards and has given endowed lectures across the country. He is a dynamic and popular teacher of both law students and undergraduates alike. And if this is not yet enough to impress you, I'll leave you with one last detail. Akhil also moonlights as a consultant for the television series The West Wing, and I'm told that the character Josh Lyman once referred to Akhil by name during one of the shows. John and Risa will each speak for about 15 minutes, followed by Akhil, who will speak for roughly half an hour. After the conclusion of Akhil's remarks, we'll open the floor to questions and then invite you to join the speakers at an informal reception. I'll tell you now that, unfortunately, Professor Amar will not be able to stay too long after the presentation because he is driving back to New Haven this evening so he can make it to his classes for tomorrow. Please join me in welcoming all the speakers.
Thank you, Jim. The part about the West Wing is extremely impressive, although I must say that the thing along those lines that Akhil has done that I continue most to envy is that several years ago he was on MTV talking about the Second Amendment. And if only I could achieve that. Perhaps if we can sell this podcast, we'll get that far. J.R.R. Tolkien said, "The gods are after all gods, and it is a matter of some moment what stories we tell about them." Well, the Constitution is, after all, the Constitution, and so it is a matter of some moment what stories we tell about it. And Akhil has written a fascinating and wonderful book that he styles a biography of America's Constitution, and so it is a story about the Constitution. And it is indeed a story. It is not just a collection of interesting facts, although it is filled with interesting facts. It is a story with a theme. And it's a basically upbeat theme, as told from the standpoint of 2006. You could say that the theme is that the Americans should embrace the gods of America, that the stories about the gods are basically good, that they should reject any new gods, and that the morals of the young should be fortified. It is, as I say, an upbeat approach. There are parts he doesn't like about the Constitution and its history, but it is basically positive. Because it is told from the standpoint of 2006, one of the leading set of themes is about equality. Equality having to do with race, equality having to do with sex, and political and economic equality. There are other very important aspects of the book, and obviously it is a massive work. At some point I need to hold it up and show it to you, so here it is. Make sure to get a good shot of this. So there's a lot in there, including an enormous amount about the presidency that is just wonderful. But I do think that a large part of the story, as Akhil intends to tell it, is about equality. And so I'm going to focus on that. And the part I'm going to talk about in a more or less critical vein, which shouldn't give the impression that I don't love the book because it's wonderful, has to do with economic and political equality, part of the large theme. And the reason for that is I read the book, and as I say, I was instructed and fascinated by it. But then on page 408, I came to something that just I couldn't deal with. Akhil was talking about the 16th Amendment, and he suggests that one of the interesting parts of the story is that the importance of the Progressive Era amendments, including the 16th Amendment, which created the federal income tax, is underestimated, that those amendments mean a lot. And so he wants us to think a lot about the 16th Amendment, the income tax, the 17th Amendment, a direct election of the senators. And he tells the story of the 16th Amendment, which grew out of the Supreme Court's decision that an 1890s income tax was unconstitutional. And that, in turn, grew out of a provision in the original Constitution requiring the apportionment among the states according to the census of direct taxes. And the question had long bedeviled the country, what exactly is a direct tax? It's clear that a capitation tax, a head tax, everybody pays $1,000, is a direct tax. It was widely believed that taxes on land by its value or on slaves by their value would be direct taxes. What else would constitute a direct tax was a hard problem of constitutional interpretation, and an important one, because the apportionment requirement meant that the per capita rate of any direct tax had to be the same from state to state. Not that it had to be the same within every state, but it had to be the same from state to state. And that meant two things. First, that direct taxes could not be used for interstate redistribution. And second, that the rate at which a direct tax could be levied, say a tax on land, on real estate, was limited by the rate that the poorest state could pay, because it had to be the same from state to state. Couldn't be higher in the richer states. Couldn't be progressive. And so the question, what is a direct tax, is actually a fairly important one. In the 1890s, Congress imposed a tax on income, something it had done before, including a tax on income derived from property, rents, dividends, interest. And the question that came before the Supreme Court of the United States was whether a tax on the income from property is a direct tax on the property, assuming a tax on the property itself, say by its value, would be a direct tax. And the Supreme Court said, yes, that is a direct tax. Now, one of the justices said, well, it may be a tax on property, but it's an indirect tax on the property, and so the one thing it isn't is a direct tax. This did not persuade a majority of the court. So they said that it was unconstitutional. And about 15 years later or so, the Congress proposed and the states ratified the 16th Amendment, providing for an income tax not a portion among the states. 16th Amendment says Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without regard to any census or enumeration. That is to say, the income tax was freed from the requirement of apportionment among the states. Income taxes could be progressive. They could have higher incidence, at least, in wealthier states, which really mattered because the interstate distribution of wealth around the time of the income tax decision and of the 16th Amendment was very uneven, especially income derived from property heavily concentrated at a small number of states. So it contemplated, and Akhil's quite right about this, contemplated a progressive income tax. But he says that such, while this is on page 408, and as I say, this is the point at which I just said, wait a minute. While the amendment's text formally addressed only national income taxes, its spirit smiled upon a range of other state and federal taxes, wealth taxes, for example, aimed at the affluent. Well, first point is, of course, any invocation of the spirit of any legal text fills me with horror. But beyond that, this reading of the 16th Amendment rather disturbed me. And that's because back when many of you were small children, and some of you were still in the planning stages, I was a tax associate. That was my first job out of law school. And so I ought to know something about the income tax under the 16th Amendment. And one of the things I know about the income tax is that it has, and excuse me for a pun, a basic concept known as, I'm sorry, it was inevitable, known as basis. Basis is fundamental to the income tax. So, for example, if taxpayer A buys something for $10,000 and then sells it for $20,000, the income from that transaction is $10,000 and not $20,000. And the way to express that is to say that the taxpayer has a basis in the asset of $10,000. And the reason there is such a thing as basis is so that the income tax will be a tax on income and not a tax on wealth. For that reason, the wealth part of the transaction has to be deducted. Income is change in wealth. The $10,000 from the transaction, the increase between the $10,000 purchase price and the $20,000 sales price, is income because it is change in wealth. And it is to be taxed. The initial $10,000 is not income, it is basis. And as we know, in the beginning, God created the Internal Revenue Code. And he said, let there be income and basis the first day. Those are as fundamental concepts as the 16th Amendment has. So it is basic to the 16th Amendment that it is not a tax on wealth. And indeed, the compromise that was struck in putting together the 16th Amendment was to relieve income taxes, and not all direct taxes, from the apportionment requirement. The question, what is a direct tax, remains with us, and indeed is one of genuine interest, since some people have suggested that certain forms of consumption tax would be actual direct taxes and so subject to the apportionment requirement, and in effect impossible without a constitutional amendment. So having been brought up short on this fundamental question of the difference between income and basis, I decided to think some more about this business of political equality and economic equality, which, as I say, is one of the main themes of the book. And in particular, one of Akhil's most interesting claims about the original Constitution, which is the part except for the 16th Amendment, that I know more about. And he says that standard accounts of the Constitution make it less democratic. He also says they make it more slavocratic. That's another one of the equality-based stories, but that's one of the ones I'm not talking about. That, in fact, the real Constitution was more democratic than it is often given credit for. And his target are people, followers of Charles Beard. And the standard Charles Beard story is the framers didn't like what they saw as the democratic excesses of state constitutions and state governments during the 1780s. That they thought the state governments during the 1780s were dominated by a single branch, the lower house of the state legislature, which did all sorts of things like have debtor relief legislation and issue paper money, and thereby favor debtors over creditors. This was very bad. This was, they would have called it communism had they known what communism was. Communism is what Justice Field called the income tax in the 1890s. So this is the same kind of people that we're talking about. And goes the account of a non-democratic constitution. The framers of the Constitution then set out to create a structure in which everything other than the lower house of the legislature would be fortified. So there would be a stronger and indirectly elected Senate, a strong and indirectly elected and independent executive, a very strong, life-tenured, independently selected judiciary, and indeed they lengthened the term for the lower house of the federal legislature and had them elected from what were, by their standards, quite large districts. The whole idea, again, goes the position that Akhil is attacking, was to make the new national constitution a lot less democratic, if by democratic you mean dominated by the lower house of the legislature and hence by the debtors over the creditors, was to make the new government a lot more non-democratic, a lot more indirectly selected and so forth. A lot more elite dominated is one way to put it than the state constitutions were. And Akhil says that's not fair to the framers. Yes, they were slavocrats, but they were also democrats more so than we give them credit for. And he has a really interesting set of insights, and I think they are a set of insights. He points to a number of features in the original Constitution that facilitated participation in the new government by people of no wealth or modest wealth. Sort of whatever it did about the suffrage of the common man and the ability of the common man to control various instrumentalities of government, some of which were quite far from the common man because of the indirect selection. The Senate in those days was selected by state legislatures, indirect selection, made it easier for the common man actually to be in the new government. So Akhil points out, no property qualifications for federal service in the Constitution. Lots of states had property qualifications for various government offices. Payment for government offices, which was not the norm, making it possible, this is like, you know, the Athenians paying for jury service, making it possible for people of limited means to serve in the government. Age limits, and this is some of the most interesting parts of the book, are about the relevance of the age limits in the Constitution. You had to be 25 to serve in the House, 30 to serve in the Senate, 35 to be President of the United States. One effect of that, Akhil points out, is to make it harder for people who are the scions of great families to be elected to some office simply because they are the scions of great families. If you're John Quincy Adams, well, you're already famous by the time you're 12 because your father is John Adams. Whereas if you're nobody, well, it's quite possible for a nobody to become famous can take a little while, like you have to get on MTV or something along those lines. And so saying you can't be elected until you're 30 to the Senate would level the playing field, Akhil suggests, and against the scions and in favor of the people who have had that 30 years to show, yeah, I am a member of Jefferson's aristocracy of talent and virtue. And I think that is all true, but I wanna somewhat discount the importance of that, because it does seem to me that given the dominance in the new constitutional structure of these mechanisms of indirect selection, the electoral system for the president going first through the state legislatures and then through the electors, for example, senators being elected by state legislatures. The structures that were put in place by the new constitution of indirect selection created a pretty strong bias in favor of the well-known already, maybe in favor of the wealthy, but certainly in favor of the well-known, and are to a large extent a substitute for the kind of measures that Akhil correctly says the new structure rejected, like, for example, wealth requirements for actually serving in the legislature or as governor. And indeed, and this is pure speculation on my part, I don't think that anybody actually thought what I'm about to say, but somebody might have. You might even have believed that the changes that the Constitution introduced, not having wealth requirements for office, having payment for government service, you could even think that that was sort of a decoy, maybe a way of causing people who thought that what really mattered was who were the people who were going to serve in the new government, think, oh, the common man can serve in the new government. But the framers, and this comes out especially in The Federalist, the framers had what some of them called a new science of politics, ways of understanding how people behaved in government, ways of understanding how people behaved in government that were much more oriented toward their incentives than previous ways of thinking how people would behave in government, and much less oriented toward their origins. Yeah, a lot of the anti-federalists were concerned with things about where will the people come from who will be in the new government, and will they be like the people? Will they themselves be the common man? But a lot of the federalists thought what really matters is what are your incentives once you get to Washington, not where did you come from. And if you think that's true, then you might well think that the ways in which the Constitution lightened up on the common man actually did not matter all that much, because what really mattered were the other structures of the Constitution. I could go on and talk a little bit about economic equality and point out that however it came down as between the common man and the elite, the original Constitution certainly was pretty strongly pro-creditor. It had the diversity jurisdiction. It had the contracts clause. Instead, I'm gonna take that as the theme for my final sort of little quarrel with Akhil. Because one thing that happened, pretty much clearly what the Federal Convention intended, was that the new federal judiciary, indirectly selected, staffed by basically elite people, serving for life, became a very good friend of the creditors. Was not always so nice to the common man. And this continued for a long time. That's what's going on in the income tax case in the 1890s. And in some sense culminated in what we call the Lochner era. And the idea underlying the jurisprudence, and Akhil is quite correct when he talks about it on this score, underlying the jurisprudence that we associate with Lochner against New York is a great principle of protecting private endowments, saying the one thing the legislature can't do is take the property of A and give it to B. And one of the really interesting ideas that Akhil suggests, to get back to my starting point and the part that I really care about, which is the 16th Amendment, is that idea that the legislature can't take the property of A and give it to B, the basis of Lochnerism, was repudiated by the 16th Amendment. Because the idea of the 16th Amendment is precisely the possibility of having a progressive income tax, not a progressive wealth tax. But a progressive income tax, that's fine. And he says it's not the 1930s that repudiated Lochner, it's actually the 19-teens and the progressives. And I'm gonna disagree with him, because it seems to me that if you put together Lochner and the 16th Amendment, say not that that one repudiates the other, but rather than one that complements the other. What you have is a structure in which the regulatory powers of government, like regulating wages and hours, say Lochner against New York, the regulatory powers of government can't be used to accomplish redistribution. You can't take the property of A and give it to B that way. But the fiscal powers of government, the taxing powers of government, can be used for redistribution. And, you know, as any good neoclassical economist knows, that's the ideal way to run the system. If you're going to have redistribution, it should be done with the fiscal powers and not with the regulatory powers. That is something that the heirs of Adam Smith continue to believe in. So as far as I'm concerned, that's a really upbeat story. And that is the point on which I'll conclude. Thank you.
It's never fun to follow John Harrison, because one can't possibly be as funny. But I will tell you, I am not talking about tax, so I see that as a plus. Before my clerkship for Justice Breyer, I first met Akhil, and it was in the context of him giving me a private tutorial on his views of the Constitution, as requested by Justice Breyer, that I have such a tutorial. And it was wonderful. I learned a lot, and it served me very well. And true to the long tradition of the student repaying the compliment of learning with a critique, I hope that I stand here as something of a peer, and I offer my comments in that spirit. So two critical insights that Amar has offered, I think, yield much fruit in the book. And the first is obviously that he organizes this comprehensive historical treatment of the Constitution around the text and the processes by which the text of the Constitution were created. And this means, most importantly, that he de-emphasizes the judicial interpretations of the Constitution that we tend to focus on in law schools. And I am very sympathetic to this decentering of the court and of judicial interpretation, though, as I'll discuss more a little bit later, I do think some greater attention to such interpretation might have further deepened the contributions that this book makes. But the focus on the text allows Amar to make historical and textual connections that are otherwise obscured, and to highlight historical contingencies that we don't generally, students and scholars of the Constitution, focus on. For example, in Amar's hands, the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery outright and without compensation, looks even more radical than it looks as a general matter, which is no small shakes. But in fact, He compares the 13th Amendment to earlier proposals by Abraham Lincoln to abolish slavery gradually over periods as long as 100 years, to compensate loyal slave owners, to incentivize African Americans to emigrate to Africa. None of these things ended up in the 13th Amendment that abolished abolition as a direct and immediate and non-compensated act. So the idea of looking not only at what's in the Constitution and how it gets interpreted, but how it gets created and how it compares to the historical context around it really renders a rich reading of our history. The second critical insight that had a really big impact on me in reading the book is the way in which, and this obviously is connected to the first, the text itself is historically situated. Now, being a historian, I have always thought about the Constitution as a historical document, and I teach it as a historical document, but debates about the form that the Constitution would take once amended were new to me that Amar talks about. And one possibility was that the amendments would just get integrated into a new, whole, coherent document. And that's not the possibility that we got. The possibility that we got was that they got appended to the end of the document with dates in little brackets. So the choice of the latter is crucial in highlighting how historical this document is. You can actually see and trace changes in the document over time. And it invites the reader, this form, invites the reader to contemplate why a particular change occurred at a particular time, to make connections between the text and the history of the United States outside the text. And Amar makes much of this form, and he gets a lot out of it. So he writes, for example, "We need only see the date 1868 alongside the 14th Amendment to understand its underlying impulse. This is a Reconstruction Amendment, and it should be read in light of the obvious evils that the 1860s reformers were aiming to abolish. An alternative word processing regime whereby later generations rewrote the Philadelphia Constitution directly, interweaving old and new language, would have obscured the link between particular words and specific historical events." He changed the way I think about the Constitution's form, about the way the Constitution itself reflects the relationship between the text and the history and the development of the document over time. And now the comprehensive focus on the text then and its historical development is thus a welcome change, one I definitely welcomed, from what is often written about the Constitution and allows these kinds of connections and contingencies that might otherwise remain obscured to become at the forefront of one's mind when reading the Constitution. That focus, however, and here's where the critique comes in, that focus, however, need not exclude the insights that can accrue from attention given as well to non-contemporaneous interpretations of the text and to historical developments less closely tied to the writing and ratification of the document. So in a postscript, Amar describes his reliance on legal scholars, historians, and political scientists. He says that he aspires to holism, and that's a worthy and difficult aspiration. And he lists a long list of legal scholars, historians, and political scientists to whom he owes debts. But he describes the three fields quite differently than the list of the folks would suggest, and much more narrowly than they would suggest. So I can't really speak to the political science literature, but I will note that it is far more expansive than simply constructing, quote, abstract mathematical models. And the list of folks that Akhil was influenced by suggests that he knows that, but there's some limitation in the way he discusses it. On law and history, though, I can say more, both because I know more about those two fields and because I felt the absence of potential contributions that those fields could make to this book as I read it. So this is how Amar describes law. He says that constitutional lawyers, quote, overemphasize the judge's doctrine and overlook the people's document. And as I said above, I agree that as a generalization, that's the case. But that doesn't mean that some greater attention to doctrine would not add more to this book, and that the other kinds of things outside of the generalization that legal scholars have focused on in recent decades, and particularly scholarship on popular as opposed to judicial constitutional interpretation, would add even more. And I'm going to talk about that more in a minute. As for history, Amar describes historical scholarship on the Constitution as limited by and largely focused on the Philadelphia Convention and James Madison. And I think, of course, my scholarship being outside of that purview and me considering myself a constitutional historian, I think that's a regrettably narrow view of constitutional history, which covers all periods, the framing of the various amendments and their interpretation, and most importantly for my purposes, contestation of individuals with the document, both within the courts and outside of the courts. Now, I appreciate that no book can do anything, and Amar himself, can do everything. My daughter uses anything in place of everything all the time. And Amar himself recognizes that the largest omission of the book is the lack of attention to what he describes as judicial doctrine and the infinity of American experiences that have left no clear textual trace in the written Constitution itself. So, it is hard to critique a book as large and as comprehensive as this one for its omissions, but I thought I would suggest three opportunities that I saw for him to draw more deeply on the historical and legal scholarship within the context of his own framework, not asking him to write a different book, but asking him, suggesting ways that I think his own book and his own project could have been enriched by these contributions. So first, I wonder if it's really possible to tell a comprehensive history of the document without looking somewhat to judicial interpretation. And in particular, I'm thinking about the ellipses in the document, the silences, the absences. The careful reader will notice certain silences in particular. For example, the gap in new amendments between 1933 and 1951. So as Amar notes, the New Deal is barely mentioned in this book because it, quote, left virtually no trace in the Constitution itself. But that in itself, that omission is a significant one, and its significance is missed unless there's some greater attention paid to judicial doctrine. So how is it the case that the progressives managed four amendments to the Constitution, while the Depression and the New Deal produced just one anti-Roosevelt amendment about presidential term limits in 1951? And you can't actually answer that question knowing anything about the revolutionary changes in the relationship between the branches of government, the federal government and the states, and governments in general and individuals, without an understanding of judicial interpretation, without an understanding that the meaning of the Constitution and the expansiveness of the federal government as a constitutional matter changed dramatically as a result of judge-made law, as a result of judicial interpretation, and that, in fact, there were proposals to amend the Constitution on the table in the 1930s, and the need for them was obviated by the actions of the Supreme Court. So I would suggest that rather than repudiate Bruce Ackerman's focus on the court, the integration of his position, or not necessarily his, but if Amar prefers, the very different interpretive history of our own Barry Cushman, might shed greater light on the shape of the document, not only what is there, but what is patently not there. The second resource that I think Amar could have used to great effect in his project was, as I said, a deeper and broader mining of legal and historical scholarship on lay constitutional consciousness of the last several decades. Recently, this has gotten a lot of press as people like Larry Kramer and Reva Siegel have written about popular constitutionalism, but the idea of talking about the Constitution in American life generally goes back at least to a symposium of 1987 in the Journal of American History and probably even before that. So scholars in this tradition focus not on the document itself or on the Supreme Court's interpretation of it, but on the interpretation of the people themselves, how that interpretation changes over time, how the people wrestle with the document, change it by protesting it, and challenging the mandarins who think that their interpretations reign to change their interpretations. So scholarship on the relationship between the document and American history broadly and public contestations over the shape of the nation specifically. And I thought I would give one example here as well. So Amar briefly discusses the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, and he does so largely as background conditions for the ratification of the 23rd, 24th, and 6th Amendments. Huh? Yeah, those amendments enfranchise the residents of the District of Columbia, those unable to pay poll taxes, and 18 to 21-year-olds, respectively, in case you're not up on the 23rd, 24th, and 26th amendments. But to see those amendments, they're significant amendments, but to see them as the primary constitutional fruits of the civil rights movement, and to discuss the civil rights movement largely in their context, is, I think, to miss the forest for a small stand of trees just beside it. Surely, those amendments resulted in greater or lesser part from the impulses of the civil rights movement. But to minimize the civil rights movement and treat it in a few sentences or paragraphs here and there, I think is to minimize its impact on the Constitution. In significant ways, the civil rights movement represented the crystallization of decades of popular constitutional thought, making their way into the mainstream of political and constitutional consciousness and into the courts and into judicial interpretations of the Constitution. But as with the New Deal, the civil rights movement succeeded, where it did succeed, in changing judicial interpretations of the Constitution rather than in changing the constitutional text itself. The end of legal segregation in Brown versus Board of Education, the embrace of one person, one vote, cases beyond these, surely these were changes to constitutional understandings, to the nature of the American polity and American society. These changes were at least as fundamental, if not more so, than the partial enfranchisement of D.C. residents and the enfranchisement of the poor and young adults. Now, in discussing these greater enfranchisements, Amar does give some discussion to legislation, not necessarily as much to judicial interpretation, though here and there there is some, but to legislation and particularly to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But again, it's hard to understand the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 or the Civil Rights Act of 1964 without greater attention to the civil rights movement that spurred its passage. Without the movement, the legislation just sort of occurs. So that means that Amar treats only one part of the complex dynamic between law and society. He gives the law credit, and rightly so, for spurring voter registration among African Americans and African American activism. But in fact, the civil rights movement and African Americans themselves spurred the passage of these civil rights acts, which in turn spurred greater activism. So the relationship between the constitutional text, popular constitutionalism, social movements and other historical developments, and judicial interpretation is a complex, historically dynamic process that can't be reduced to any single subset of those components or any single direction between them. And the effect of focusing on the text as the culmination of everything, I think, is to flatten and reduce this dynamism to some extent. Finally, and I'm running out of time. Okay. Finally, I will do without my example here then. The third effect of describing the document without these, without judicial interpretation or historical developments playing much of a role is, as I think John Harrison suggests, that the story reads as somewhat Whiggish, as a continually progressive tale. And Amar anticipates this criticism, and he does respond to it, although it is in a footnote in a postscript. And I did still feel that the focus on the document to the exclusion of historical and judicial interpretations and historical developments leads to this kind of progressive narrative. The document itself, as Amar suggests, does get progressively more democratic, does enfranchise more people over time. But if you look at the subsequent history, if you look at the subsequent judicial interpretations, for example, the end of Reconstruction and the disenfranchisement and segregation and marginalization of African Americans, the Reconstruction Amendments standing on their own don't look nearly so powerful once you look at that history in some more detail. So I will not talk about my last example, but I want to conclude by saying that none of this is to detract from the immense accomplishment of bringing together so much historical analysis of the Constitution or from the contributions the attention to text and enactment have made to the fields of law, history, and political science. It is merely to point out where greater integration of these other literatures may have yielded even greater rewards. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always such a great pleasure to be back here at the University of Virginia. It's an especial pleasure to be on such a distinguished panel. Thanks.
so much for coming. And if I could just indulge one personal note, thanks so much to my own constitutional law professor, who's now your dean, John Jeffries, for being here. It means a lot to me, John. So, let me tell you four things about the Constitution. And several of these have been anticipated, and I'll try to integrate my summaries of these points. I'll try to integrate into my summary of these points some thoughts about the very useful comments that you've heard. So here are my four points. The Constitution was, as John Harrison recounted to you, in my view, far more democratic than we've conventionally understood. Second, it was far more slavocratic than is widely appreciated. Third, and John mentioned that, it's more about national security and continental defense than has been, and geography even, geostrategy, than has been conventionally appreciated. Here, the work of, say, Professor Onuf in UVA's own history department, I think, is quite significant. And finally, the Constitution is much more unfinished, both at the founding and today, than we often understand. And I think here, Risa, is where I think my book is unfinished. There's one more book still to be written, at least one more, I hope. I'm not that old yet. And it will talk about things like popular constitutionalism and the 1930s and the 1960s and case law. And there's stuff still in the written Constitution to be done. So there's work to be done by you, not just by me. So here are the four points. More democratic than you were taught. John is right. We are all indirectly students, in effect, of Charles Beard, who said the Constitution was basically of, by, and for the rich. And George Washington's one of the richest guys in America, and they are sort of, the founders are lining their own pockets in some, to some extent. These are the people, said Beard, who have invested in all sorts of government bonds and securities, and that's why they're supporting a constitution, so they can get the 100 cents back on the dollar. It's all about creditors. When Madison says so in the Federalist 10, by the way, when he actually says it's all about the class issue, and a kind of proto-Marxian account that Beard revives. I'm going to say more about Federalist 10 in a little bit. You all have read Federalist 10 because you all have a particular connection to Mr. Madison. I think 10 is rather less significant than you've been taught, and no one pays any attention to it before Charles Beard, interestingly enough, and that's a provable fact. See Douglas Adair's work on Federalist 10, but I'm getting ahead of my story. George Washington's the richest guy in the country, so this must be of and by and for the rich. Now, what Beard doesn't quite tell you is, who were the leading people against the Constitution? Well, I'm here in Virginia, George Mason. He's got at least as many slaves as George Washington. He's against the Constitution. Let's talk about the Lees of Virginia. They've got a lot of slaves. They're pretty rich guys. They're against the Constitution. I do not think the Constitution is about rich against poor. It doesn't say we the property. Beard says, well, of course they wouldn't say it. They just sort of wink it, and this is all this sort of secret reading, and it's sort of in there between the lines. Sounds a little bit like spirit to me, John, although you're not supposed to be a spirit guy. But in fact, you are, and that's the problem, actually, when you claim that only I'm a spirit guy. So I'm going to come back to that, too, because I think I gotcha. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So doesn't say we the property, it says we the people, and that's not just a set of words. Here's something that Beard doesn't quite tell you. The Constitution is not just a text, it's a deed. It's a constituting, it's a doing. We the people do ordain and establish. It's what John Austin will call a performative utterance. Sometimes when you say a certain set of words, you actually do something. Since John teaches everything, including contracts, when you say, I accept, you've just accepted. When you say, I promise, you've just promised. At a very special moment in your life, when you say, I do, you've just done it. So do it carefully. And when we said, we do, We did something. We, the people, did something. The Constitution was put to a special vote. It was a year-long process of conversation and contestation. And the fix is most definitely not in. Charles Beard is not a good historian to the extent that he actually treats the Constitution as having bootstrapped itself into existence. Well, if it really was of, by, and for the property folk, why did people ratify it, you might wonder? And Beard doesn't quite have an account of that. And who ratified it? And here Beard hid the evidence. The who and the fix was not in, because a full 9 months after the Philadelphia Convention has unveiled its proposal, it unveils it on September 17, 1787, full 9 months after, the Constitution is still struggling to be born and its fate is uncertain. Then New Hampshire says yes, it's the ninth state. Then, of course, it's really important what Virginia says, and Virginia says yes before it hears from New Hampshire, and then New York says yes. The vote in the New York ratifying convention is 30-27. Two people change their mind. The Constitution is not ratified in the New York convention, and it's very hard to have America work without its deep water ports and Hudson River. This was a gutsy move to put this thing up to a vote. Hadn't happened in world history before the American Revolution. Ancient Greece had democratic constitutions, but not a democratic constitution making we due process. One person, the lawgiver, Solon, Lycurgus, like Moses on a mountaintop, gives the people of Athens, of Sparta, their law. So democratic constitutions, yes, democratic constitution making, no, they didn't vote on their own constitutions in Athens and Sparta or pre-imperial Rome or Florence or Venice or Switzerland. The English Constitution that you've heard so much about, well, it's never reduced to a text. And it is important, Risa, what's in the text and what's not in the text. That's a democratic thing, that ordinary people can actually read it and decide. Ordinary farmers, it's short enough so that people can read it and decide whether they're going to vote for it or against it. And all this stuff that's not in it, it's really important, and a full book deserves to be written about it, at least one. But it is different than what's in the text. Actually, because we the people actually vote on certain things, and we don't quite do the same for other things, important though they be. In England, the Constitution is never, the English Constitution is a set of unwritten rules, principles, maxims, that practices, institutions that have evolved over the years, and some of them are somewhat democratic, but some are aristocratic, and some are monocratic, and monarchical, and they've never been reduced to a single text voted on even by Parliament, much less the English people. And the Declaration of Independence isn't voted for in 1776, it's not put up to a vote. And neither are any of the state constitutions in 1776, including Virginia, where the de facto legislature just promulgates the Constitution on its own, like an ordinary law, without even an intervening election to give the citizens some fair notice that something specially important is afoot. The Articles of Confederation aren't directly ratified in any sort of special way. The Constitution is put to a vote, and it could lose. And it's very gutsy for them to do that, because only two states have ever done that in history, Massachusetts and New Hampshire in 1780 and 1784. And here's the track record. There are six different constitutions proposed in those two states, only two successful ratifications. When you propose a new constitution, basically here's what you know. You're batting about 333. Okay, that's a very gutsy move then to put this thing up for a vote. And they do it. And they could have lost, and they almost did, and North Carolina says no, the fix is not in, and Rhode Island says no. So when George Washington takes office as the first president of the United States, there are only 11 states in the new union. So it was not rigged. And here's what Beard also didn't tell you. The people that were allowed to vote on the Constitution in 8 of the 13 states were people who didn't meet the ordinary property qualifications for voting or serving. In other words, people were allowed to vote on the Constitution even though they couldn't vote for the ordinary state legislature in some states. In other states, people were allowed to serve in this special convention that was going to decide whether to vote up the Constitution up or down, even though they weren't eligible to serve in their state legislatures. Property qualifications were reduced or eliminated in 8 of the 13 states. Nowhere were they raised. The Constitution starts out, we the people, now you begin to understand why it starts out. We the people do ordain and establish this Constitution. That's actually a rather big deal, and it's not to be taken for granted, and it's a very democratic populist thing. And Charles Beard knew some of those facts and didn't tell his audience. In fact, I have some evidence for that in the notes. The word property, let's actually look at the text of the Constitution and judge whether it's about the people or the property. The word property appears not at all in the preamble, not we the property, not in the, and then in the deed of the doing of it, which is rather important. Property is actually diminished compared to its status before. And the unamended Constitution, the original Constitution, features the word property exactly once, and that's in a reference to government property in Article 4, I believe. John will correct me if I'm wrong about that. And then I agree with Risa. We have to look at it as a historical document. Is it liberal? Is it conservative? Is it pro-property? Is it anti-property? Here's what you have to judge it by, not the standards of 2006. John wants you to think I'm writing this from the perspective of 2006. I disagree with him. I'm trying to write it as an historian. So to judge a 1787 document, let's judge it by the standards of 1787 or 1786. So how does it allow more or fewer people to vote than the day before? And the answer is more. Are the property qualifications higher or lower than they were the day before? The answer is lower, and in the case of New York, for example, non-existent. All adult, free male citizens are allowed to vote in New York for the first time in history. Or whether they're going to ratify the Constitution for this special constitutional convention. John says, well, you have this indirectly elected Senate. That's true, but you know what? You had that under the Articles of Confederation, so that's not news. That's just a perpetuate. That's not taking a step backward. That's just not taking a step forward, judged by the standards of 1787. He says, well, the House of Representatives, the Congress is actually kind of small, and that's going to advantage well-off people. And I actually talk about that. I think that's true. I think that's one of the larger democratic problems with the Constitution. But it's no smaller than the Congress under the Articles of Confederation. In fact, it's bigger. In the Articles of Confederation, there are 13 states. Each one gets a maximum of 7. 7 times 13 is what, 91? Well, that turns out to be exactly the same size as the first Congress. 65 members of the House of Representatives, 26 senators, that equals 91. And you never had 91 people or anything close ever showing up under the Articles of Confederation, because a state, if it sent two people, could cast a vote, so why pay the extra salary for the third or fourth or fifth or sixth or seventh? So you never had anything close to 91 people in that Confederation Congress, and you have a lot more who show up in the Congress, in fact, because the more people show up, the more votes your state is casting. So, and the anti-federalists say it's too small, and so the federalists actually propose a constitutional amendment. It's the original First Amendment. It says Congress needs to be bigger, and by the time the amendment actually comes up for ratification, the Congress has already expanded, because they say, oh, the 65 thing, that was just a temporary rule until the first census, but after the first census comes along, Congress will need to be a lot bigger, and it is a lot bigger, and they build a pretty big house, a pretty big Capitol building. I was just there this morning, and it's a pretty sizable thing. You compare that to the buildings in Williamsburg or Independence Hall, it's 50 times as big, because they actually do want it to be the people's house. So, John gave you some other evidence, no property qualifications for the Senate, for example. It's not just that most states had property qualifications for the Senate. Every state had property qualifications for its upper house if it had an upper house. Pennsylvania didn't have one, but every other state did. No property qualifications for the president. Every state had property qualifications for its governor. Pennsylvania didn't really have a governor, so I exempt it. So, judged by the standards of 1787, this is a remarkably egalitarian document, actually, and not about we the property, in fact. No religious tests. 11 state constitutions actually had religious tests in them, and a 12th state didn't have religious tests, but it wasn't a constitutional protection, and then they added them. New York, only Virginia doesn't have religious tests. And that's only by statute that's subject to change. It doesn't have a provision in its constitution. It's not in George Mason's Declaration of Rights, a Bill of Rights in 1776, that there's no religious test. So judged by the standards of its day, it is remarkably democratic, actually. So that's the first point. As an historian, compared to what were the rules the day before? Now, that's the nice news. And it becomes more so over time, in its text. And in practice, we take two steps forward and take a step back. We promise black men the vote in the 15th Amendment, and then we don't redeem that for 100 years. But the text actually There's no 15th and a half amendment that repeals that. So it's actually important, it seems to me, that the text moves in a certain direction and a certain trend line. And that's not the entirety of our constitutional experience. But I actually am writing a book about the written Constitution. And I think actually there are advantages to bringing all this other stuff in, and there are disadvantages if you don't keep that separate from the written Constitution. So it needs to be part of the whole story. I don't think it needs to be part of this book. And I'm going to come back to Reese's point, because I'm going to read you the last paragraph of the postscript, which is about the stuff still to be done, the book still to be written, and the work still to be done. But before I get there, it's more slavocratic than you were taught. So it was more democratic, but alas, it's more slavocratic. So they have this electoral college, and you were taught it's because they didn't believe in democracy, but I've given you some evidence that they really did believe in democracy, more so than anyone ever before had ever done, putting the Constitution to a vote and not having property qualifications or lower property qualifications for this we do act of ordainment and establishment and for ordinary government elections, no federal qualifications even to be president of the United States. And states can't add them even. And we've had poor presidents of the United States, not just in one sense of not very good presidents, but in the other sense, the more democratic sense of not very wealthy presidents. So, the Electoral College, is that because they weren't Democrats? No, that's not why they had the Electoral College. And in fact, state legislatures from the very beginning, half of them let their citizens directly vote for presidential electors, and this becomes the dominant pattern as early as 1804. So why didn't they have direct election for the presidency? Well, one reason is just because here's another thing. They believed in direct election of governors, the Federalists did. And they created a directly elected House of Representatives, which was different from the Articles of Confederation, where the congressmen weren't directly elected. So again, compared to what happened the day before, they're giving you more democracy. So they adopted the Electoral College not because they're anti-Democrats, but there are a couple of problems. One is a problem of information. How would people in Georgia know about good candidates in Massachusetts and vice versa? You'd know who's good in your own state, but it's hard before you have modern communication technology, the rise of national political parties and other things. It's hard for ordinary people to necessarily be able to judge candidates from other states. But the real reason that they had the Electoral College is slavery. Because if you had a direct vote for the presidency, the South would always lose because it doesn't let its people vote. So James Wilson from Pennsylvania says, you know, we should pick our presidents by direct election. And James Madison says, you're right, in theory we should, in principle we should, but I've just done the math and this is not going to work for the South, probably. But if we have an electoral college, you see, we can count our slaves with a certain kind of discount, three-fifths clause or something, and that we can sell to the South. So the three-fifths clause is a remarkably slavocratic provision. It gives the South extra credit for its slaves. For every extra slave that the South steals across an ocean, kidnaps from Africa, or imports from the Caribbean, or breeds, and there's a lot of breeding going on here in Virginia, for every extra slave, you get extra credit in the House of Representatives and extra seats in the Electoral College. So, for 32 of the first 36 years, you have a slaveholding Virginian in the presidency. And that's by design, largely. Oh, you also told maybe Electoral College is about balancing big states and small states. Well, if it is, how come the big state guy always wins? You know, Virginia's the biggest state, and it's got 32 of the first 36 years, and then the other time it's Massachusetts, which is one of the other three big states. And in all of American history, there have only been three small state presidents. The entirety of American history. Bill Clinton from Arkansas, Franklin Pierce from New Hampshire, and Zachary Taylor. Whether you count him as a Kentuckian or Louisianan. I know he was born just over here near Mr. Madison's birthplace. So if they were about, it's about protecting small states. Boy, they weren't very good political scientists, and I think they were pretty good political scientists. It wasn't about protecting small states. It wasn't because they're anti-democratic. It's because it's slavery, stupid. That's what it's about. And the Three-Fifths Clause is a remarkably pro-slavery provision. It delivers a lot of political power in the House of Representatives and the Electoral College, and therefore the presidency and ultimately the courts, because pro-slavery presidents pick pro-slavery courts, gives a lot of power to a slaveholding society. And that problem becomes worse and worse and worse as the decades go on. So it'd be nice if we just, you might say, well, you know, they didn't get rid of slavery, but they were kind of neutral on the topic, and they set the stage for ultimate abolition. That's not how we get rid of slavery. There's no sort of gradual abolition that happens. What happens is we have increasingly pro-slavery regimes, culminating in elections of people like James Buchanan, either southern slavocrats like Andrew Jackson or northern men of southern sympathies like James Buchanan, and they deliver the Supreme Court over the South. The South has one-third of the free population and the majority of Supreme Court justices. The Supreme Court is malapportioned, and it's malapportioned because the Electoral College is malapportioned because of the Three-Fifths Clause. And the system becomes increasingly pro-slavery, and then you have a crisis and a civil war, and the Constitution fails, and 500,000 people die, and that's why you get an abolitionist 13th Amendment. Not because the system actually sort of worked and gradually solved this problem, but because it broke, and it broke so badly that Mr. Lincoln was able to move it, and his party able to move everything in a different direction, partly because the South absented itself from the federal councils, which was a dumb move for them because they were winning the game. This is like when the Soviet Union leaves the United Nations in the 1950s and allows the U.S. to get certain things through the Security Council in the Korean conflict. More democratic, more slavocratic, you say, how can both be true? I say, think Andrew Jackson, low-born man of the people, but very pro-slavery and pro-Western expansion. And that's the third theme. So the Constitution is more Jacksonian in its principles than we've been taught. It was not aristocratic and neutral on slavery. It was democratic and pro-slavery, which is why that Constitution gives you Jackson's America. It was also much more about national security. We have been taught that basically the basic argument for union, we've been taught, is set forth in the Federalist, in a certain Federalist paper. How many of you have read in high school, college, or law school the Federalist number 10? Okay. And how many of you have read the Federalist number 4, 5, or 6? One is my former student. 8. If I had to read one Federalist paper, I'd say Federalist 8 is the key, but 4, 5, and 6 are important. If you had to really, look, democracy has never, in 1787, has never existed in the history of the world over a large territorial expanse. And conventional political science says it can't be done. You need a homogeneity of culture, of religion, of language, of culture. Warm weather people and cold weather people really can't govern together. We're just different sorts. That's conventional political science. Now, what's being proposed is a vast, and if you're going to have when Rome is a city-state, yes, it can be self-governing, but when it's going to basically be an empire encompassing all sorts of lands with different religions and time zones and climatic zones, you need an emperor and a standing army and heavy taxes but what's being proposed by the Federalists is this continental democracy, the likes of which have never before been seen in human history. And the first thing people say is, why do we need that? Why should we trade away the states that we've had, that were colonies first, that saw us through the American Revolution for what's behind door number 3? And you've all been taught it's because Jimmy Madison came up with this really nifty idea in the Federalist 10. Here's his idea. This new Congress will be more protective of minority rights than your state legislature will be. And it'll protect propertied people, and that's why Charles Beard thinks this is the key, and other sorts of minorities, and heterogeneity is actually better than homogeneity. Democracies work better if they're actually different sorts of a variety of factions and parties and interests. Brilliant. Probably correct. makes a lot of sense of much of the rest of American history, like the Civil War, which and the 14th Amendment, in which the national government emerges as an important protector of Brown versus Board of Education, an important protector of rights against states, a protector of minority rights. Brilliant idea. And no one pays any attention whatsoever to it at the founding. And Douglas Adair has shown this in his work. Beard rediscovers it, and you all read it today. If you had a really good argument for, because here's the first question, why do we need this? If you had a really good argument, would you wait till your 10th essay to make it? You know, if you wait until 50 pages into the brief to actually give the judge your best argument, I hope that's not what you're learning here at the University of Virginia Law School. You lead with good arguments, and the Federalists do lead with different sets of arguments, a geostrategic argument. Oh, by the way, let me just make clear. So the Virginia House of Burgesses starts meeting in the 1620s. So it's now it's been renamed the House of Delegates after the American Revolution, but it's over 160 years old when the Constitution is being proposed. It's older for Virginians than the 14th Amendment is for us in this room. And James Madison comes along and says, trade away your Virginia House of Burgesses, put all this power in this newfangled Congress, Continental Electoral Congress, only 65 people for the whole continent, when you have 300 people in the Virginia House of Burgesses alone, House of Delegates, trade that away for what I'm offering behind door number three, because that's going to, because I've got this really nifty theory that that's actually going to be better for liberty. Well, that's a very hard sell, and people do not buy that argument. Why does Edmund Randolph from Virginia, for example, who is questioning, not sure about the Constitution, why does he in Virginia ultimately support it? You know, George Washington is not a high-flying political theorist. What's his idea of the Union? What's the Federalist Papers' idea? And it's, when I said earlier it's national security stupid, it's slavery stupid, this answer here is it's national security, okay? Madison says to Virginians, vote, can you really trust your Virginia House of Burgesses? Wouldn't you want a better check on them? And most Virginians would say, yes, we actually can trust our House of Burgesses. It's been around for a long time. Here's the other earlier Federalist Papers. Can you really trust those Pennsylvanians? And remember, Virginia borders on Pennsylvania because it includes what's now in West Virginia and Kentucky. And can you trust the British? Can you even trust the French and the Spanish? Well, maybe not. If Virginia goes it alone, and each state goes it alone, we'll start to fight amongst each other, basically over who controls the West. And we'll start to kill each other, and we'll develop armies and trade wars, and we'll be just like the continent of Europe, where no one's free. If instead, my fellow Americans, you know, that's one choice. Second choice is you can stick with the Articles of Confederation, but we almost lost the last war under it, and we're going to lose the next one. Might be against the French, might be against the British, might be against the Spanish, but this is not going to hold. Or you can go for what's behind door number three, which is a continental union, a more perfect union, modeled on the union of Scotland and England. My fellow Americans, look around the world and ask yourself who's tolerably free. And the answer is Switzerland, the Swiss and the British. Why the Swiss? What do they have in common? Not language, not religion. They've got the Alps. That's what makes the Swiss the Swiss. And it's hard to charge up a hill, you see. The Great Wall of the Alps is a very important protector of liberty, and Britain has the Channel. But before Britain became Britain, it was England and Scotland, and they started fighting with each other, and Hadrian's Wall was no Alps, was no Great Wall of China, and so Mel Gibson's always coming down and whomping on the English, and the French are coming in and playing the English off against the Scottish, but when Britain formed a more perfect union, a perfect union of Scotland and England, the island became much more free because now it can rely on a navy rather than an army. A navy is much less, has to be able to beat the Spanish Armada, but the navy is much less threatening to domestic liberty. And if we can do that, my fellow Americans, create a more perfect union for national security reasons, eliminate land borders in effect. We'll have an English Channel times 50 called the Atlantic Ocean. We won't need a big army at all, just a very small army. We can rely on a navy. We will kill the Indians. kick the old powers of Europe out of this hemisphere and rule this hemisphere. We'll be hegemons in our hemisphere. That's why we'll be free. And it turned out to work. And that's actually Publius' argument, Manifest Destiny, the Monroe Doctrine, it's all there. George Washington understands that. He's a general. He's a surveyor. He understands all of that. And that's actually the argument for union. Much of the progress, the march of history, has been about actually our wars. Women get the vote in World War I, 18-year-olds in the Vietnam era, black men after the Civil War because they're fighting for the Union cause. So more democratic, more slavocratic, and that's not a contradiction, more about national security and geostrategy. And then finally, more unfinished. So much of what we celebrate today is not from the founding, but later acts of popular sovereignty, the Reconstruction Amendments that gives us the woman suffrage movement, the 1960s amendments, and there's stuff still to be written. John, here's the problem with, I think, your critique. There's nothing in the original Constitution that actually prohibits redistribution unless you read it at a certain high level of generality in a spiritual way. There's the Contracts Clause, but it doesn't even apply against the federal government. It's only about contracts. That's the only thing in the original Constitution. States can't print up paper money, but actually the federal government can and did in the American Revolution, and there's no prohibition against that. And the federal government is given the power to coin money, and nothing says it has to be gold and silver the way states have to be gold and silver. So they have copper from the beginning. And if they can have copper, why not tin? And if they can have tin, why not paper? So, and there's no rule that precious metals have to be, sort of, coins have to have a certain percentage of precious metals worth their weight or anything like that. So there's nothing in the original Constitution, really, about anti-redistribution. And you can say, well, the system was designed to create a certain sort of legislatures who would likely oppose redistribution, but if they don't, if they actually support redistribution, where do courts get the warrant to say that's unconstitutional? And you can say, the Takings Clause, which is part of the Fifth Amendment, well, it doesn't originally apply against the states, and it's only about takings of real property, and it's not just about all forms of regulation, regulating minimum hours and maximum ages that might, minimum wages and maximum hours that might be redistributed. You have to read that way the heck high level of generality to get the Lochner principle. And here's all I want to say. If you are willing to do that for the founding, you have to be equally willing to read later acts of popular sovereignty at the same level of spirit and generality. So here's what the 13th Amendment does. Risa mentioned it briefly. It affects immediate, universal, and uncompensated emancipation. Even for loyal masters in Union states, a Union Army general has his lawful, he was never disloyal, slavery was always legal in his home state, let's say it was Delaware or something, and the 13th Amendment takes away his property without any compensation whatsoever. It's a massive change in the redistribution, if you will, of the property regime, and you have to take that seriously as a deed. And then you have to take seriously the 14th Amendment, which actually says in Section 4 of it, it goes beyond the fact of uncompensated emancipation and sticks it further, saying, neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any claim for the loss or emancipation of any slave, but all such claims shall be held illegal and void. So prohibiting, even if a government wanted to, compensation of the loyal slave master. So that's the 13th and 14th Amendments. And then the 16th Amendment comes along and says you can have a progressive redistributive income tax, and if you can, and I also do take the position, by the way, that the Pollock case was completely wrong, that the direct tax provision just doesn't apply beyond capitation and land, and I have a whole page on that in the end notes. This is a matter of some awkwardness for me, because the man who came up with the theory that John, it's at page, John, 613, and it's a good page and a half, I think, in which I explain just why the Pollock case is ridiculous. There's a guy who dissents in Pollock. There are four dissenters, in fact. But one of them is named John Marshall Harlan. He's going to dissent the next year in Plessy versus Ferguson. And he says, this is a disaster. I mean, he's very clear that this is not just wrong, but deeply wrong. Now, here's the awkwardness. The guy who came up with the theory that this tax on rental income was a kind of impermissible direct tax in violation of the direct class tax clause of the Constitution, the guy who came up with that theory, his name was Charles Southmaid. And I hold the chair that Yale University has in his honor. So this is a little awkward for me. I take some solace in the fact that the previous occupant of the chair was the greatest tax scholar in America, Boris Bittker, and he agreed with me about Fat John, about Pollock, and says so in his treatise. So my first argument is I think Pollock is just wrong from the day it was decided. I don't have to rely on the 16th Amendment for the idea that all sorts of other redistributive things are constitutional. I can just say there's no bar in it in the Constitution, but if you're going to pump up the level of generality of the takings clause, of the contracts clause, and say that generates a prohibition against regulatory redistribution, if you're going to do that, if you're going to be a spirit guy, John, you got to be a spirit guy who takes seriously subsequent acts of popular sovereignty, like the 13th and the 14th and the 16th Amendments. But if you don't want to be a spirit guy, fine, then you tell me, the 16th Amendment just applies to income taxes, that's perfectly okay, but you tell me where in the Constitution it actually says you can't have redistributive policies and that judges have the authority to strike down legislative acts that redistribute. Okay, more democratic, I'm about to close. More slavocratic, more geostrategic, and much less complete than... We tend to study too much the framing. And there's, of course, lots of historians who are doing lots of work, but there's just so much, Risa, about the framing, and not nearly enough, even among the great historians, about... the later period. What we celebrate today, women's equality, blacks' equality, a Bill of Rights, not part of the original document. The most important part of the Constitution is that vast white space after the last amendment. It's about what your generation could add to the document. And I want you to see that you're part of a tradition in deciding what to add to it. And it is a Whiggish story when I say almost every generation that has added to it has improved the document, has extended liberty and equality in the text rather than retrenched it. American history hasn't been Whiggish because they promised the 15th Amendment and then they don't enforce it. But the American constitutional tradition has been Whiggish. Here's how I end the book. And here's how I'd like to end this talk. Here's the end of the postscript. We need at least one more book to start where this one ends, because mine's been an account of the written Constitution. But we need one more book to start where this one ends, giving readers a detailed account of America's unwritten Constitution. Such a book could canvass Supreme Court case law, could assess quasi-constitutional framework statutes that have emerged and endured in America, like the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, could ponder other foundational American legal texts, like the Declaration of Independence and the Northwest Ordinance, and these important civil rights laws from the 1960s, could examine unwritten customs of Americans worthy of constitutional protection, could systematically consider other modern constitutions across the globe, for the wisdom doubtless embedded in many of these documents, could reflect on the teachings of past and present political philosophers, and here's the final thing, and could assess particularly plausible proposals for new constitutional amendments. So the next book is going to be America's unwritten Constitution, mine at least, next book, America's unwritten Constitution, between the lines and beyond the text. And it's going to be about the judicial constitution and the framework statutes and the constitution outside courts, but maybe the most important part of the unwritten constitution is the constitution still to be written. That's part of the unwritten constitution. The founders gave us a better world than they had inherited. So did the Reconstruction generation. So did the progressives. So did people in the 1960s with a series of amendments. And so I leave basically with the question and the challenge to your generation. What, if anything, will you add to the Constitution? Thank you very much. Maybe they would like to respond since I had a whack at them. They should get a crack at me.
Would either of you like to say anything before we open up the floor for questions?
Well, I will deny the accusation of Griswoldism, which is essentially what Akhil made, and say briefly that he is absolutely right. And I don't mean to suggest that the Constitution contains or should be interpreted as if it contained a provision that said no redistribution. It contains a number of much more specific provisions than that, like the Contracts Clause, which is a lot more specific than that, like the requirement of apportionment of direct taxes, which is a lot more specific than that. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the approach the framers took sort of demonstrates, and whether I'm a Griswoldite is not important. I'm not. But this point is, because it's a problem in drafting a constitution, anything you want to last for a long time. There are two basic approaches. One is to operate at a very low level of abstraction and deal with the problems that you're familiar with, like, for example, the emission by states of bills of credit, which are explicitly forbidden by Article 1, Section 10. And to try to deal in specifics. Now, the problem with dealing in specifics is that you can't anticipate what's going to happen. If what you're really concerned about is redistribution, well, various new mechanisms of redistribution may arise, mm-hmm. and the specific tools that you use to prevent redistribution may themselves not work as times change. For example, the framers, in another attempt to prevent interregional distribution, required uniformity of non-direct taxes, geographic uniformity. It turns out that it's quite possible to have geographically uniform non-direct taxes, excises, and imposts that have serious redistributive consequences. And you can't do that if you've drafted it at a low level. You can't do anything about that if you drafted it at a low level of abstraction. So that's right. Now, the weakness of drafting at a higher level of abstraction is that, of course, you are, this is rules and standards. You are, in effect, delegating authority to future decision makers who may not share your views as to what is a good idea. So if you say there shouldn't be any redistribution, very high level of abstraction, that's got its own problems. 150 years later, in the hands of a very different set of political actors, including but not limited to the courts, they may well do things quite unlike what you would have wanted. That's why it's really hard to draft constitutions.
I want to leave time for questions, so I'm going to say something very quickly, which is I look forward to the next book. But I still maintain that this book would be the richer for some of that being in here. And I also would point out that this is called America's Constitution, not America's Written Constitution. And so to the extent that the written and the unwritten have interactions and interplays that are fruitful, the book implies that it will go further than that. But I look forward to the next one.
Now, Risa, you're about to get this book published by Harvard Press, and I really commend you on that. I can tell you, I don't know if it would have been richer. It would definitely have been thicker and heavier and denser. It would have sold fewer copies. It would have gotten fewer people to read. It would be more like a treatise, and there are costs to that. Here's a remarkable thing about this document, is it is so short. So there are costs and there are benefits. So every author, this is actually an important point, I think, actually, about what's a fair review and what's not. I think you're right. Authors should be judged based on the book that they chose to write rather than the book that they could have written. Then there's the second. So I actually chose to write a book about the written Constitution. I'm going to stand by that because I really thought about this a lot, and I actually think the unwritten be a separate book, and then maybe at some point I'll try to synthesize them in yet another project. But then the question is there any bait and switch? Is there anything misleading? And it's hard to capture an elegant sort of title, all the aspects of what a book is and isn't. So is there a sort of bait and switch if you're expecting something about the case law? And I worried about that. It doesn't say America's written constitution because that doesn't scan as well. And without the subtitles, a biography and creation reconstruction, you know, sometimes it's very interesting. I get introduced. Akhil Amar is author of The Bill of Rights in America's Constitution. And now this worries me also, see, because, does the guy think he's James Madison or something? So, but I did actually, from the very, literally, the first page, in my, I have a preface, and I say, just to be clear, this is a book about the written Constitution. And so if that's, and I did that because I thought a person in a bookstore could take a look at least at the first page, and I'm cueing her or him. So I actually don't think there's a, but I took it very seriously. But I think actually it would not be a fair criticism of your book to say it's not about the income tax amendment. And some people think that the income tax amendment is a form of involuntary servitude because they have to work for the first 2.5 months of every year before they pay, before they reach tax day or whatever it is, tax freedom day or something. There is such a thing, John, I'm sure. Yes. Well, so
I'm not there yet.
Really?
No.
Okay. Okay. So
the president's working on it.
So then can I respond?
Okay, more? So this is going to go on now into an endless loop.
Can I have one more response?
Yeah, but this is it.
This is it. Yeah. This is it, I promise. So I would say that the final example I was going to use before when I ran out of time is I think the one that shows not only added richness, mm-hmm. but a certain kind of bait and switch, mm-hmm. which is references outside the text that I think can be misleading. So mm-hmm. you talk about these enfranchisements and the various enfranchisements, and you point out that the southern states had not ratified the earlier enfranchising amendments, and then they do ratify the 18 to 21-year-olds. And you point out, you make the argument, that this is evidence of racial and geographic reunification. And you talk about how the late 60s and early 70s were years of extraordinary dynamism. In fact, they were. They were years of extraordinary upheaval, of assassinations, of riots, of real strife and tension. And if there was racial and geographic unification, it was among white northern ethnics and southern whites who had a backlash and voted for Nixon in a very different kind of unification than the one you allude to. And so I think that by alluding outside of the text in particular ways and focusing on the particular textual points, it's not just that I want to say you would be richer, but that there are places where you would be more correct, perhaps.
I think you're right. And I think I ran out of space. Remember what I told you before? It's much less about the founding than you thought, and yet two-thirds of the book, because two-thirds of the text is actually about the founding, and I really started worrying about my page count. So I think there's much more to be said, actually, about the 20th century amendments than I was able to do, because I couldn't quite figure out what pages to cut, and I just didn't want it to be any bigger. So I think you're right.